Good evening, everyone. It's on. Yeah. Good evening. Okay, couple quick announcements. So the discussion group will continue, but we will start meeting in the Gompa instead of around the table, so we have a little bit more room. So please join us after the class if you would like to stay for the discussion group. It's an informal discussion group to discuss what we had talked about previously. Also, just so you know, starting tonight, I think we're going to start locking the front door after about 15 minutes after class has started, so around like 7:15, 7:20. So if you come late, just knock or something. We'll try to let you in. So I guess the point is try to get here on time if possible. And then let's see, what else? I feel like there was something else. Oh, silence your cell phones. There is childcare provided. I haven't said that already, and I feel like I'm forgetting something, but if I think of it, I'll tell you later. All right, we'll go ahead and get started. Thanks, everybody. I remembered what it was. We have one more class after tonight. So next Monday is the last class of this module. And then we'll have a few week break, and we'll start the next module at the beginning of May. Wow, that's crazy. Yeah.
Anybody here? First time? Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me now? Okay. All right. Anybody here new? Let's see. Well, one hand. Hey. Well, you can just hang in there. Are y'all from the school or just checking it out? What do you want to learn? What do you need to know? We can get it out of the way real quick. So you have to write a paper about tonight? Oh my goodness, okay. Well, good luck. By the way, this class has never been taught before. Like this, anyway. All right, where are prayers? Let's do those first. I've heard some rumblings about people wanting to know something about some of the rituals that we do before we... I think there's so many options here. Where are the prayers for the teachings? There's so many. They're all over the book, and they're repeated multiple times. So, Brother, this is one of the features of Tibetan Buddhism, is disorganization. And we don't... First time I went to a... You go to a Zen place, everything just pop, pop. Everything's really organized, but Tibetans are different. I'm not Tibetan, but... Well. Refuge in Bodhicitta. Come on, people. Help me here. Oh, there we go. All right. So I'm going to teach y'all... I'm going to teach y'all how to be Buddhist here. Not that anybody would, you don't have to be, but so usually if you were going to do this practice at home, if you had a daily practice, you know, you get up in the morning and you'd set up your altar, right? This is, you know, what we're talking about is collecting and cleansing, cleansing the mind of negative karma and creating some positive karma. So the meditation starts out with that kind of spin. So you get up, and I'm not saying everybody does this, but this is recommended. And you'd have your, you might start out with three prostrations. So I'm going to show you how there are different ways to do them. In fact, there are mental prostrations, let's back up a minute and talk about what that word means. It's a way of paying homage, you know, respect, showing humility. Because one of the biggest obstacles to learning is what? Pride, arrogance, yeah. If you know everything, you can't learn anything. So this is a great antidote to pride and arrogance. But it's also a way of paying respect and we don't pray to statues, but they symbolize the enlightened consciousness, right? All the Buddhas that have come before, and our own potential to be that. Okay, so there's a mental prostration. Then you can do it. You know, in Zen, there's a lot of bowing. That's a prostration, or just putting your hands together at your heart is a form of prostration. And then there's the one we typically do is a half prostration. And get over here so you can see me better, maybe. Don't know if the camera's following me or not. But anyway, so half prostration, we put our, anybody know what the left hand and right hand stand? You see this is called a mudra, hand mudra. Anybody know what this means? Pardon? Yeah, you were going to ask that. Good question. I was getting ready to answer it. So usually, for example, I don't know why, but the left symbolizes female energy and wisdom, and the right symbolizes male energy and method. The principal method is being compassion. And then in Tibetan tradition, you tuck your thumb in. So that's kind of weird. Other traditions like that, but the Tibetan tradition. And so you imagine you're holding a wish fulfilling gem. And what is a wish fulfilling gem? Mythically, it was this jewel or gem that could ask for anything, and your wishes would be fulfilled. And what is the source of all of our happiness and all of our wishes come true? It's all living beings. So that it really symbolizes all living beings, because living beings are our wish fulfilling gems. So you got that going. Then we imagine. Now there's a lot of ways you can do it. You can imagine that from the image of the Buddha, like this rainbow light nectar coming in to your body, speech, and mind. And usually we start out with the hands on the top of the head, and we touch the forehead, which is, anybody know what a chakra is? It's kind of a strange word. It's not a common word, but anyway, there in yoga and prana, different yogic traditions, we talk about different chakras. So there's one here. So you touch this has to do with the body, and then this one, the neck, there's a chakra here that has to do with speech, and then the heart, the mind is considered to be at the heart. So you touch there. So as you do that, you start here and you touch these three areas, and you imagine that light and nectar are entering your body, speech, and mind, and is purifying your negative karma of body, speech, and mind. And then you do something, and I remember the first class I went to, and we're talking a long time ago now, right? 78, as a matter of fact. And Lama Yeshe, there were like 200 and some people there, and people were complaining about prostrations. They were going like, like Westerners. It was all mostly Westerners. Almost everybody was from Europe, a few Americans, a lot of Australians and New Zealanders. And they just, nobody wanted to bow. And it was like, I'm not bowing to anybody, you know? And Lama Yeshe's, her answer to that was, well, you know, sometimes it's just good to put your head on the ground. That was all he said. But anyway, this again, if you understand the benefits of it, then you might want to do it, because it is to train our mind, you know, so we can benefit from the teachings, and we imagine that we're purifying body, speech, and mind. So you put your hands up here, and you imagine as you're doing this that light and nectar are entering your body, and your speech and your mind are all purified for the sake of others. Right? We practice in this tradition to become enlightened in order to help others. When you go down on your knees and your hands, and you touch your forehead to the ground, and then stand back up, and you do it three times. Now, before I do the last one, anybody want to do it with me? Get up. There's a mantra too, to add a little bit of mystical power to it too. There's a mantra that you can do that even it makes it even more powerful. Some people here might know it. It's Om Namo. This is Sanskrit. Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Susriye Namo Uttama Sriye Soa. So we'll do three prostrations. And you can do it mentally or not at all. So we'll just Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Susriye Namo Uttamasriye Soa. Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Susriye Namo Uttamasriye Soa. Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Susriye Namo Uttamasriye Soa. And then you do three more times. All right, now, you've cleaned up before you do this, before you do your daily practice. I think there's a course called How to Establish a Daily Practice, isn't there? Yeah, so anyway, you'd go over here and you'd set up your little water bowls. We offer water. Now, this is a trick question. Why do we offer water? There's plenty of it, yeah? You can water plants out. Those are all good answers, but they're not the one I'm looking for. Yeah. So another good answer, but not the one. Well, let me tell you what each bowl stands for. This is water for drinking. So if you imagine somebody came in, like some visitor came in from a long trip, you know, you'd give them water for drinking, okay? Then you give them water to clean up and bathe. Then you give them argan, platinum, pupae, flowers, and then incense, light. Argan, pajam, pupae, dupe, light is, aloke is light, gande is incense, nuide is food and sound, something like that. So anyway, there are eight things, and they're Sanskrit words, water for drinking, water for bathing, flowers, pajam, pupae. Basin, incense, light, and so on. Anyway, these are all the things that you would give somebody when they were, you know, give them light, give them food, help them clean up, give them some nice oil to put on their body so they didn't smell bad, and then you'd give them some food, and then like that. So we imagine that we're making these offerings, and we're using water because we're trying to offer something that we're trying to train ourselves to make, to be generous and offer things without attachment. Okay? So there's plenty of water. Nobody gets attached to water, right? Because we think there's a lot of that. So we practice, you know, we use water, fill up the water bowls. And again, this is a way to get our mind prepared for the meditation by practicing generosity. Okay? So we've purified our body, speech, and mind. We've done a little practice of generosity. And then we sit down and we do these prayers. And the prayers, again, this is all about collecting and cleansing. But it's also about setting our motivation. Because, as I said earlier, Lama Zopa had said many times, Lama Yeshe, but Lama Zopa too, the most important part of the practice is our motivation. If your motivation is, if we're honest, probably most of us, our motivation is just to be happy now. That'd be a good, that's not a bad motivation, is it? And that's a good motivation, actually. It's a good place to start. But the motivation that brings the results of enlightenment and is also brings makes the meditation way more powerful because it's dedicated to all living beings, is this motivation to become enlightened for the sake of all living beings. So our goal is to help all living beings, and the method for doing that is enlightenment. And what is that? Well, it's eliminating our negative states of mind, you know, negative actions of body, speech, and mind, but everything's controlled by the mind. So we're eliminating our faults and developing our qualities. When we've completely eliminated all suffering, what is that called? What's the freedom from suffering called? Well, it's that too. Nirvana. Yeah, the total cessation of suffering is nirvana. And that is actually the goal of the Theravada tradition is nirvana. The Mahayana would, you know, the goal is not only to stop our own suffering, but to stop the suffering of the world. But it takes a lot more work. That's, you know, the path to enlightenment is a lot, is longer and somehow more rigorous. But, the goal is supreme enlightenment for the sake of others. So that becomes the motivation for practice. And in the beginning, is it easy? you think is how we normally think? Heck no. We normally want our own happiness, right? So we train to in this thing called the awakening mind of the bodhicitta, and it's called effortful bodhicitta. In other words, it's not easy because it's going totally antithetical to the ego. The ego wants, I want happiness for me now. And here, we're dedicating our practice to others. It's completely antithetical to the ego. So, it's, anyway, so we set up our practice that way. And then we do these, we think about that. That's the motivation. So, remember we talked about last time, and Robbie did too, the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. The first two stanzas would separate somebody who's a Buddhist from not a Buddhist, right? A Buddhist goes to refuge, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha Dharma and the Supreme Assembly. So a Buddhist, that's who they would go for refuge. I mean, refuge means seeking a safe, positive direction in your life. So you would, that's where you would go, is to the teachings of the Buddha, to the enlightened beings, their teachings, and the spiritual community, but also your own potential for enlightenment, your potential to realize the Dharma, and your potential to be part of that spiritual community, all the things that you're going to refuge for. So that's the first two stanzas. So that's what we say. And then the last two have to do with our motivation, by the practice of giving and other perfections. So those are the bodhisattva practices. There are six perfections. Anybody know them? We got a lot of academicians in here. Well, you got that one right. But that one was said. Practice of giving. Patience. What? Ethics. What now? Joyful effort. Concentration, wisdom. Did somebody say patience?
Yes.
All right, patience, patient endurance. All right, so those are the, so you use this, usually this listed like this, it's usually is generosity. All right, there's generosity, there's material generosity. There's actually giving protection is a kind of generosity. And one of the best ways to protect others is to control our mind, isn't it? To be a safe place, a safe space, you might say, for people to be around. You know, we know who. So, and then giving the Dharma is another kind of generosity. So there's generosity and there's ethics. And we want to, everybody hears the word ethics and they go for, you know, they think, oh my gosh, can't have any fun anymore. That's not what we're talking about. Actually, we can't have any fun if we're not ethical, because ultimately we know we're poisoning ourselves. So ethics means not harming ourselves in the short run or the long run, because you know you could do something like somebody who's a mass murderer or whatever might get a big thrill out of doing something really horrific, but that creates some sort of surge of energy. But long term, they're going to have a hellacious, they're going to face lots and lots of problems, let's put it that way. So anyway, so ethics is non-harming. So we got generosity, ethics, patience is intolerance. So patience is sort of the antidote to anger, isn't it? If we don't have, is there any chance at all in this life to be happy if you're a hothead or you don't have patience? No. So it's, and can it be trained? Can we be trained? Yeah, we can be trained. But for honestly, for some of us, we thought and think that that not only experiencing our anger, but like vomiting it all over everybody, somehow is a way of cleansing ourselves of anger. And it doesn't work that way. It just builds the habit to be that way more and more. And it destroys our relationships. It's not helpful. Patience, on the other hand, which is really hard to develop, takes effort, you know. But we can be trained to do that when we understand the benefits of patience and tolerance. So that's number three. Then there's enthusiastic perseverance. That means that we don't give up easily. You know, we have enthusiasm for what? For the practice of virtue. For the practice of virtue. So that's Dharma practice, meditation practice. It could be going to the, to the food shelter and handing, you know, feeding the guys or feeding the girls. There's different food shelters in town. I took my kids a few times to the men's food shelter. That was an experience. And so that's enthusiastic perseverance. Is enthusiasm for the practice of Dharma, because this is not easy. This is the hardest thing you will ever do. I promise you. Confronting your own mind and your delusions, and then unraveling the confusion that created it, and then developing virtuous states of mind, replacing it, is just a huge, monumental effort. I wish there was a pill for it. I keep waiting for science to come up with a pill, but Prozac does some things. But you know, there's a lot of good drugs out there, but none of them help us develop these kinds of qualities. And there's concentration, which is just what we've been practicing, which I think is the main practice of the main purpose of this course, is the concentration. And then there's wisdom, the wisdom of selflessness, seeing things as they are. Anybody know what that is? Give me the 25 words or less. What wisdom is? What does that mean? That's the right answer, by the way. Yeah, it is hard to describe. But here's a little quick. There's the selflessness of persons ourselves. And there's a selflessness of phenomena, which is everything out there. And so here's what it, ignorance, pride, jealousy. By the way, there are 86,000 delusions. So that's a few of them. But they all are motivated by selfish, self-centered mind, right? And the Buddha saw through that illusion of a separate self. See, what we currently do now, if I pointed at somebody and embarrassed them, let's say, anybody want to get embarrassed? No, just kidding. But if I Lama Yeshe did that to me one time, and in the middle of 100, probably 200 people, my head almost exploded. I got so embarrassed, but I got to see the sense of self that is normally there, but all of a sudden it was like huge. And what we ordinarily do is, there is a self, right? Doesn't everybody exist? I mean, if you're here breathing, you are real. You know, you do exist. We all exist. We all have a self, right? And that's labeled, we have what's called the nominal self. Just a label based on what? A body and a mind. That's really all we are if we really look at it. All we are is a collection of parts, the body and the mind. Sometimes we call them the aggregates. And then on top of that, we label that self. But no, we don't stop there. Ignorance, which is goes way, way back. Ignorance projects a separate sense of self, like a bigger sense of self. And we believe that We believe that that self is real. Like, I exist. That is beyond the self that we just talked about, the nominal self. We project a false sense of self, and then we cling to it. We grasp onto it. It's called self-grasping ignorance. And it is the source of all of our suffering. And we have to recognize that false sense of self and to realize that that doesn't exist. That is not who we are. And so we talk about emptiness of self. Really what we're saying is that I exist, but not that false, that giant, hardwired, egocentric, you know, self-centered person. That's not who I am. And so, you know, through analysis and understanding and meditation practice, we can begin to see that that self that seems to be so hardwired and real, as we go, we recognize that it doesn't exist. We are empty, void of that false sense of self. And what's left is who we really are, right? So we don't have to defend ourselves. You know, you can't get somebody who's completely selfless. You think you can piss them off? Heck no. Are they going to get all attached and clingy to things? No, because all that depends on this false sense of self that we project. So anyway, that's... You know, and then there's the selflessness of others. It's kind of like you cannot find, I better not go there. Never get out of here. But anyway, let's just put it this way. What is this? Now, how do you know it's a pen? When did you learn that this was a pen? I mean, does a newborn baby see a pen? No. At some point, you see this collection of parts that functions to write, and the label pen all come together, and now you can see a pen. But before that, you couldn't see a pen. A dog would walk in here, and if I held this thing out, what do you think the dog would do? You think the dog would see a pen? No. The dog would chew on this thing. So, you know, our perception, our mind creates our world. Our mind projects our reality. The little frames that are stacked together? I guess in digital movies and stuff now, they still have frames? Probably not. But anyway, the frames that make up the movie of our lives created by karma, by our own former actions. Because there's no objective reality out there that exists independent of our mind creates our world, which is great news because we can purify our mind. Our mind is malleable. We can change our mind. If we're having a hard time, we can improve our situation with time and effort. But this is, like I said, moderate effort over time. This is not a quick fix. But it's been practiced for 2,500 years, and it works for some people. But it might not work for everybody. So, you know, the Buddha, so there are people in this room, they'll never come back here after this class. I can hear Robina saying this right now, but I agree with her. And that's really okay. It's okay not to come back. Because this isn't your karma. You don't have the connection with these teachings. And so you can go find another, maybe there's a church, or maybe there's another group, or maybe you'll invent your own spiritual practice that works for you. It's okay. This is just the Buddha Dharma version. This is the medicine that the Buddha came up with 2,500 years ago, and it invited us to You know, he said, come check it out for yourself. If it works, great. Please put it into practice. And you don't have to swallow it all at one time. It's like a huge banquet. You pick and choose what works for you like that. So again, I'm getting ready to do the prayers here, but I want to go over the Four Noble Truths one more time. Remember what we talked about? Because I left you in a bad place last week, I'm afraid. I think Gunaratna, I think he handled dukkha pretty good, don't you? Did anybody go home and like not sleep or like depressed for the last week or anything? I hope not. Because he did say something very optimistic. He said, look, you know, dukkha is this unsatisfactoriness, right? The first of the noble truths. When the Buddha got enlightened and he walked to Sarnath and he talked to his first set of disciples and he taught the four noble truths. And dukkha was the first thing he taught. And dukkha means, it's a Sanskrit word. It's translated as suffering, but it's way broader than that. It's like unsatisfactory. It's like, you know, we can all see the suffering of like getting burned or breaking a hand or depression or, you know, having all of our 401k being ripped off or our spouse leaving us or whatever. You know, all kinds of mental and physical suffering. Everybody sees that. No problem with that. The other kind of suffering though that we don't see is that everything changes. We don't see that, do we? We don't see that. How many people have been sitting perfectly still since they got here? Nobody. We fidget. Why? Because it changes, doesn't it? You start getting hard. The seat gets hard. We got to move, you know. You go, well, it's getting too hot in here. And you go outside where it's cooler. And after a while, it gets too cool. And you got to come back inside because things change. You know, we live in a world where there's constant change. Nothing. No pleasurable experience. I don't care how wonderful it is. It doesn't last. It turns into suffering. If nothing else, we know that it's going to end, and that makes us suffer. And this, you just look at anything that you now consider, quote, the source of happiness, and it won't last. It might be that relationship. It might be your family. It might be your children. Everything is in a state of flux, and it's completely random. We have no control. We think we do, but it's completely out of our control. We have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, I might go to work tomorrow, and then boom, half my body, you know, just goes like this. I don't know. Or I promise with a room this big, there's some people that have heard the word cancer, right? There's people that have had cancer. We might hear that. There's just no way of predicting what is going to happen. We live in a world, we call it samsara. It's this process of uncontrolled causation, and it's completely random. And it drives us crazy because we want control. We want to be able to get things to stay and don't move and don't change and stay the way. But it doesn't work that way. And that's why I told you that monk that meditated for 3 years, when he said what he got out of it was impermanence. That was huge. That was huge. And I'm not talking about just some understanding, but he got it in his, you know, literally in his beingness, that he understood that nothing is worth clinging to because everything's in a state of flux. So, all right, so we got dukkha, first noble truth. And this is what I was talking to Dwight about this earlier too. When we when he was talking about all the ways that we're suffering and all, you know, it sounded almost hopeless. But he was also in really what he was saying. He, at the end, he said, but the good news is we can stop it. There's a way out, right? So he wasn't saying, hey, nah, look what you got to deal with. You're all going to get old and sick and die, and everything you have is going to be taken away from you, including your loved ones and all your stuff. It's going to Goodwill when it's all said and done. And then it's probably half of it's going to end up in the junk pile because even Goodwill won't take it. You know, that happens to people. And, you know, it's crazy. So there's dukkha, and then it's important to get that and get a sense of that in the context of understanding dukkha, it's the determination to be free. You know, we understand that there's suffering, but it can stop. And so that's actually the third noble truth. But the first thing the Buddha said was you're sick. All worldlings are deluded, and that's us, right? Then he said there's a cause for suffering, and it's the delusions, it's these mental afflictions, greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, jealousy, 84,000, right? Those are the delusions that create karma that causes the suffering. So here's dukkha, that we're sick here, and here's the cause of it, karma and delusions. And the principal delusion is what? The false sense of self that creates all this mess. Then the fourth thing the Buddha said, he said, look, great, we can cure this. You got an illness. We found the cause of the illness. I found the cause of the illness. And this thing can be cured. You can, no other spiritual tradition or certainly psychology. I think I said this in the first class. Freud said that best we can hope for is to take people with, who are really unhappy and sort of turn their life into everyday unhappiness or something like that. Just neuroses. Just you can't. Enlightenment's not really the goal of psychotherapy. It's just to help us diminish our suffering. But in Buddha Dharma, they said it's possible to stop our suffering. And even if we can dial it down a little bit, that's really good. That's really cool. And then the fourth noble truth was that there's a path. Okay? And from the Theravada tradition, we talk about three things: ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And from the Mahayana tradition, say it's all included, but they're kind of intertwined. We talk about renunciation, which is this determination to be free of suffering. Compassion, and that's compassion for yourself, isn't it? Then we have compassion for others, which is bodhicitta, this wish to become enlightened for others. Okay? And then wisdom, which is the wisdom of emptiness. So that's the path. So the Buddha was really very helpful. He said, yeah, it's pretty bad. And if we, with the kind of minds we have, it is going to be bad. And there's a cause for the sickness. And it's karma and delusions. And you can be cured. Yay. Something to get excited about. And we have a precious life that is going like, it'll be gone before we know it. Want it. I mean, isn't it? Just think about it. Yesterday, last week, last month, our lives are going by so fast. We don't have much time. If you want to stop your suffering, now's the time to do it. Not put it off until next month or next year, because it may never come, right? So you can stop your suffering, and here's the path to do it. So that's what the Buddhists take refuge in. And those are the six perfections. And then the four immeasurables, and immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And remember the definition, the definition of love is may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. Is that love? No. Those are words. Those are just words. Do you feel any? If you have feeling, if you say those words to somebody and you mean it, and you have this non-conceptual feeling that goes with those words, that is love. Love is not it's a non-conceptual experience. The words are, you know, they use the example of the finger pointing at the moon. You know, that's not love. Those are the words. They're pointing at something called love. And compassion is the same way. May you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That's not compassion. That's the definition of compassion. When you look at somebody, by the way, if you don't feel close to somebody that's suffering and they're suffering, if you hate them, I know there are a lot of people here that are Trump haters, right? Raise your hand. No, I'm just kidding. anyway, it doesn't help our mind to hate anybody, does it? If there's somebody that you dislike and they're suffering, you actually can rejoice, which then you get the negative karma of harming. So that's not good. So to develop true compassion, you have to feel connected and a feeling of a genuine affection. Then when you see someone suffering, you feel, may you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Like if you saw your only child was like, you know, suffering, you know, sick, and with a ventilator tube in their throat, and you knew that there was a life and death situation, you know, oh my God, you'd be going, you know, your thought would be, may my child be free of suffering and the cause. You wouldn't say those words. You would have the feeling of compassion. That's what we're trying to generate. Not a bunch of words, but actually the feeling of compassion. So, all right. And then the seven-limb prayer. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. Again, this is the prostrations that we did earlier. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. So offering, practicing generosity, is the antidote for what? What? Yeah, greed, clinging. It's the antidote. So practicing generosity benefits us, because we're training ourselves to not be stingy. Okay? So I present clouds. So you imagine that you're offering all these clouds of offerings. We declare all of our negative actions accumulated since beginningless time. So we're actually acknowledging what we've done. You know? If we haven't done it in this life, we've done it in past lives. We've all killed. We've all killing, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh, these are the biggies, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, and ignorance. So those are the three of body, or killing and stealing and adultery, and the four of speech are lying, slander, harsh, and frivolous talk, and the big three of mind are greed, hatred, and ignorance. So we've all done that stuff, you know. So we want to acknowledge that so we can let it go. And that's part of the purification process, is to be brutally honest with ourselves. I think in certain 12-step programs, they say you have to take like a serious inventory of your life. Of the things that you've done and the people you've harmed. And I could tell you a story about that, but I won't bore you. Anyway, so that's really important. So that's part of it, getting our mind straight, and that is to declare our negative actions. Rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Rejoicing is a way of, whenever we do something positive, if we rejoice in that. Is that like, and I'm trying to make a distinction here between the this ego, you know, like you see a lot of sports, you know, these guys that they make the basket, they catch the touchdown, and they run out like, it was all me, when there's 10 guys behind them that made it possible, but no, it was all me, you know. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking, whenever we do something positive and we rejoice, it causes us to want to do more of that positive action. So rejoicing is actually good for our mind, but it's also an antidote to what delusion? You get anybody who has the answer to this gets 10 extra points on the final exam. Rejoicing is the antidote to what delusion? What's now? It could be, if you're rejoicing in your good qualities, you know, it could be. But usually we think it's the antidote to jealousy. Like, I remember when the first time I heard Lama Yeshu was saying, look, if somebody takes your wife or husband and, you know, you should rejoice that they can have found happiness with somebody else. Because otherwise you're just going to kill yourself with jealousy. You're going to be so jealous. So rejoice that she or he has found somebody that they can now find temporary happiness with. Because you know it's not going to last. But hey, that, you know, take care of yourself. Rejoice. So rejoicing is an antidote to jealousy. You know, you walk into a room and you see somebody who's like, if you know, drop dead gorgeous or super handsome, and you know they're all youthful and they got all the things that you want or think you want, and you go, oh, you get jealous. And what? No, rejoice in those that they have those nice qualities. They won't last, but you might as well rejoice that they have those qualities. Because they, for example, the karmic cause of a nice physical appearance is having practiced patience in a past lifetime. So they did that. That body is not it's not just a random thing. It arose from causes and conditions. So it's rejoicing. And then we say, please remain until the end of cyclic existence. So we beseech the teachers to stay and teach the Dharma, because we find, you know, it's precious. And we see it as the potential source for the ending of our suffering and our ability to stop the suffering of others. To turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings is to teach it all living beings, and then to dedicate my own merits and those of all of those to great enlightenment. So dedication is a way of like sealing the deal, you might say. We've done something positive, and so we're not just hanging on to the positive merit for just us, the positive potential that we created, the seeds that we planted in our garden, but we're going to share them with universal living beings. Okay, so that's kind of what that's about. And then the mandala offering, this ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with meru. Remember, we have this mudra. We just imagine that, if you're a Buddhist practitioner, you imagine that you're willing to offer everything in the universe, gold, silver, whatever it is, everything that's beautiful and wonderful, all kinds of sensory pleasures, whatever it is, you're willing to offer that to the holy, you know, to the gurus, to the teachers who are giving us these teachings. We're offering that to them, you know, for the teachings. They don't need it, but we're offering it because that's what we need to do. Okay? So I don't think we need to say the prayers. I've just gone through, but you get the point. Okay. I think we're almost done here. No, we got time. All right, any questions about what I've said so far? I cannot believe it. questions. You can ask questions while my back is turned. If I don't get any questions, then we're going to do Zazen for 30 minutes. Make everybody suffer. Then you'll know the truth of suffering. Sit perfectly still and don't move. All right. So this, in Thailand, you know, the places in, that I studied Vipassana meditation, the main thing, and I can't remember the Sanskrit word for battery dead?
Yep.
Well, it's back now.
That's okay.
Okay. The Pali terms for this. But working now?
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you. Help me with this too now. But the you know, when I was there, that monk who had spent 3 years meditating, he said that. I said, "What did you get out of it?" And he said, a stronger sense of impermanence." And he was talking about impermanence, not only gross impermanence like getting old, sick, and die, but so much subtle impermanence. And so, you know, our mind is changing all the time. When you say, when anybody says present moment, what is present moment, by the way? Present moment, you know, if this is already the past, isn't it? This moment is already behind us. The Dalai Lama says a great meditator is somebody who's focused on the next moment of consciousness with clarity and awareness. That's what His Holiness said. So if you get that things are constantly in a state of flux, constantly changing, I'm not talking about understanding it, but you, in your meditation practice, you watch your mind change for hours and days and years of practice. And you see that, you know, that delusions come into the mind and then they disappear, don't they? Anger doesn't last forever. Attachment and lust don't last forever. Fear and boredom don't last forever. These delusions and also pleasant experiences, you know, enjoyments, all that, whatever it is, it's impermanent. So understanding that everything is in a constant state of flux, that these are all kind of the same thing. You know, that when you understand that we cling to what? Concepts, people, you name it, feelings, whatever arises in the body and mind, and objects, things like people and so forth. We live in a world where we want things to stay the same. We cling in a world where things are changing. So that's going to cause suffering. So until we can learn to let go, and that's really moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, to being constantly aware of impermanence, until we get there, we're bound to suffer. But it is possible to train ourselves to be present to the reality of impermanence, not just understand it, because that's the booby prize. Understanding means nothing. It's actually getting it in the same way that we get compassion and we get loving kindness. Okay? And also, because things are changing all the time, where's the self? This, the self of you, 1 millisecond ago, is not, no longer exist. This already is, this who we are, this sense of a self, is in a constant state of flux. So there's no point at which you can say, there I am, because you've already changed. There you are, you've already changed. So there is no self that exists permanently. Okay? There is a self. We've already talked about the nominal self. But from this particular perspective, you know, understanding impermanence is gives us an understanding of dukkha and of no self. So when you have, when we're sitting and meditating and we have anger arises in the mind, what do we tend to think of? What comes to our mind usually when we have anger? Don't we think my anger? We don't think, oh, anger. Pride. Fear. Boredom. No, we go, my boredom, my fear, my death, my happiness, my this. It's, we attach the ego to it. But there is no self. There is no permanent, unchanging self. It's just this constant flux of body and mind. That's who we are. We're just this going through time, and eventually we'll stop. We won't exist anymore. So this is a key thing in terms of understanding the kinds of meditation that we're doing. When I was, anyway, like what I said, no self is different than the emptiness of inherent existence that we talk about in the Mahayana tradition, which we call the wisdom of emptiness. This is a different understanding, but it's extremely powerful to get that. You know, I love it when stuff comes up in the mind and I go, you know, boredom instead of my boredom. That's a real relief. When we stop tagging our ego on all of the stuff that comes through our mind. Okay, so who wants to do a little meditation since I've been talking nonstop? Any questions? I know I'm not that clear, so I guess the questions will come afterwards when we leave. You guys will be left here to grapple with whatever. Time is it? 8:05. Seriously, any questions relevant to this? Yeah. I won't make up an answer.
It's related with the awareness.
I'm sorry?
Related with the awareness we have. So we are aware.
Yeah.
That we are aware. So are we the awareness?
That one's beyond me. Yeah, I mean, we experience awareness. Our mind, that's the as Robbie said in the last class, the purpose of the mind is to perceive, right? So we the mind has to have an object to perceive, but yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
Well, since there is no self, then we couldn't be the awareness.
Pardon?
Since there is no self, we could not be the awareness. Because the question was, are we the awareness?
Well, if
there is no self, then we could not be the awareness.
No, there is a nominal self, right? But there's no permanent self. There's no like, there you are. It's just, there's a self, but it's an interdependent, it's a body and mind that depend on each other, constantly going through time. That's what gets labeled self. And there is awareness, right?
But that is not one and the same.
What is not one and the same?
What we label as the self and awareness itself.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. I mean, what we label as the self and awareness, yeah, they're not the same. But we have to have, I mean, this is getting into words now, isn't it? But, I mean, there has to be awareness of a self to label a self. There has to be awareness to even label it, right? Anyway. So let's, again, this is, I'd like to, I wanted to, I had plans to play Gunnar Ratna giving a talk on Vipassana, but it's pretty heavy. Goes on and on, 22 minutes. I think it put people to sleep. So let's do a meditation. And I'm actually going to, I picked this one out myself.
Can we take one more question, Don?
One of my heroes. Yeah. Go ahead.
So any thoughts on the practicality of kind of moving through your day and being labeled externally continuously by others?
Say that again.
Any thoughts on, you know, as we move through our days, we are labeled and told who we are by, and these days with technology is by many others. And are there any thoughts or, I guess, practical ideas on how to deal with that?
I don't really understand the question. Give me an example how that would be a problem.
You're a doctor.
Yeah.
So when we're labeled, how, any thoughts on how to deal with that?
Well, it has a function, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, being labeled, it functions, but it's not who I, you know, that's not who I am. It's just my job. And it's not even, you know, when I go home, I get labeled dad. And go someplace else, I get labeled customer. And I go somewhere else, I get another label. So, is that getting at what your question is? It's not a big deal. You know, we have to function because, you know, we live in a world where, I mean, emptiness doesn't mean that things don't function or that labels disappear. We just, when somebody, as I understand it, when somebody who understands emptiness really gets it, they still label things, but they don't believe in the labels. They don't have some sort of kind, like they see somebody who's being a jerk, and the mind goes, you know, says, you know, labels this person a jerk or an enemy or somebody like that. Somebody who understands emptiness recognizes this, but doesn't buy it. Doesn't buy into the labels. They use the example of like a magician. When a magician is doing a trick, the magician knows how they do the trick, but everybody else is deceived, right? And it's the same way. You know, we understand how our mind is working and how it labels things, and we don't get hooked in a way that's going to cause delusions like greed and hatred and all the things that poison our mind. Any other questions? Dwight, you have anything?
I do.
I figured you did.
I know you regret this.
I didn't have a
You said something early about Lama Yeshe and showing somebody their, he showed them their self as if he helped them to see that self right then and there through shame, embarrassment. Could you touch on that again?
Well, this was about, this was my perception anyway, because I was the one. he called on me to say something in a room full of people. And it just, normally when we're meditating on emptiness, this false sense of self, we can't see it. Like right now, in this moment, your body is sitting and your mind is thinking. Where's the I? Right? Where's the I? Is it like, is there some separate I that exists independent of our body and mind? No, there isn't. The Buddhist perspective is there's a body and a mind. There's these, what we call them, the five aggregates. There's a body and four mental aggregates. These aggregates make up who we are, and based on that, we label, ourself. Now, ordinarily, we don't see this false I, because it's kind of subtle. It operates sort of under the radar, off the grid, so to speak. But when we get angry, or when we feel some strong emotion, or embarrassment, or, somebody makes us really proud, or somebody gives us the prize, and then we get all inflated, then we can see it. So it's when we're meditating on emptiness, we need these opportunities where the sense of self gets inflated, so we can examine how it exists, and how it appears to exist. And the claim is that it appears to exist separate. It's like a separate sense of self that's solid and hardwired and real. And that's who we are. And we believe in it. And we'll die for it. And we'll steal for it. And we'll do anything for this mistaken sense of I. So that's the point, is that, not necessarily. And Lama, a good teacher, will show you your mind.
Show me my mind.
Yes, sirree. Like Lama Yeshe showing me my mind when he pointed me out in the group of in 200 people, and I got all embarrassed. I went, wow, that was pretty powerful. So a good teacher gives you opportunities. A good teacher's job is not necessarily to fluff your aura. Is to give you opportunities to confront all your demons.
Don, I think you're a good teacher, and I want to experience this. And I want you to show me my mind.
Well, I'm not that good.
Maybe you sell yourself
short. I tell you
short.
What, though, if you find, Geshe-la, you go talk to Geshe-la. Geshe-la Gelug, he's like a nice, mild-mannered guy. But I'm telling you, he's got some arrows in his quiver. He can operate all across the spectrum, and whatever a student needs, he's good at that. And a really good guru or teacher can do that. There are all kinds of stories about how somebody pissed off the Zen teacher, and he picks him up and takes him and throws him out of the room, And they have a moment of enlightenment. That's what they needed. So a good teacher is not necessarily somebody that says what we want to hear. They're somebody that challenges us. All right. So let's sit up straight. I'm gonna This is, how much time are we in here? All right. So we're going to just do a, we're going to do a focus on the breath. And we're going to use, as long as, you know, as we talked about last time, like the mind is like a wild elephant, right? And it just wants to go. Just wants to go all over the place. And so we tether the wild elephant of the mind to a stake, all right, with mindfulness. So when the, and eventually the wild elephant will settle down. So in the same way, as we focus the mind on the breath, which is like the stake, and the mind goes every which way, as soon as we know that it's gone, we bring it back. And you know, you may go the whole meditation and not even realize your mind's been distracted. And that's okay. But gradually, you definitely want to get to the point where you bring the mind back again and again and again until it becomes more more effortless. Well, let's focus on, take a few deep breaths to get started. And then notice your body and just the experience of sitting. Your feet, if you're in the chair, your feet on the floor, your back in the chair, your bottom in the chair, your shoulders a little bit back, your chin down, your eyes slightly closed or just slightly open, tongue at the roof of the mouth. And you just follow, wherever you experience the breath more readily. Sometimes, you know, we assume for people it's the tip of the nose, but maybe it's not. You can, you know, you can feel the, as you breathe out, as you breathe in, it's cooler, and as you breathe out, it's warmer. But you can focus on the breath at the nostrils, or if it's easier, it might be the rising and falling of the chest or the rising and fall of the abdomen. Wherever it is, bring your full attention to that place. And just gently follow the breath. If your mind gets distracted, you bring it back. You might label thinking, or you might have something that, you know, you might have some lustful thoughts. You might label attachment or fear or boredom. Whatever the experience is, sometimes it's helpful. For some people, it's not helpful. But for some people, it's helpful just to label the, you know, when you catch yourself being gone, you just label it like thinking, thinking, thinking. And then you can bring your mind back to the breath a little easier that way. And sometimes it's not easy, you know. It's something will come into the mind, like you know, an image of somebody that you intensely dislike, and you just cannot let go. You're going, you know, aversion, 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 but it's not going. This person, this image of this person is not going away. So what do you do? How do you handle that? So sometimes we have to switch gears and meditate on the antidote to aversion, which would be loving kindness, which you might not want to do. But if you want to let go of aversion, you need an antidote. You try to develop some kind of sincere feeling of loving kindness toward this person. And you might use some words like, may you be safe, be happy, be healthy, live with ease. Say there's a phrases over and over again, if you can get a feeling for that. Or you might use some of the lines of reasoning we talked about in other classes, where you go, hey, this person is just like me, just wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. We're all exactly the same. You know, they've done something that offended me or hurt my feelings or hurt somebody that I love. You know, they will suffer, and they have suffered. Try to come up with some reasons to develop some positive feeling toward this object of aversion. Even if you can just get back to neutral, that's pretty good. And then you can, you know, maybe bring the mind back to the breath. And on the other side of it could be something that we're attached to that we cannot let go of. You know, we notice some person or experience that we really crave. And you know, this is particularly could be related to various kinds of addictions too, right? And it's hard to let go of wanting. And so we can't do that. We use whatever antidote we can come up with, and one of them might be to see the impermanence of this desirable object. That it won't last. And we see the shortcomings of attachment and clinging. Causes us to suffer. And this person that we think is so marvelous and wonderful and can't live without, you know, could become your worst enemy. Could become somebody that you don't, you know, even the sight of that person causes you, you know, to feel negative feelings. Could change. Relationships are changeable. So we get that kind of thinking and let go of, lessen the attachment to the desirable object, since we weren't able to let go of it just spontaneously. And maybe now we can bring the mind back to the breath. And we can finish up with one one meditation that I want to do this more next week, because this is like, I haven't really done many Tibetan, the Mahayana practices, but I do want to do, next week we'll do more of this one, but it's called Tonglen, or taking and giving. Has to do with developing compassion, love, and kindness. And also next week we'll do a purification practice called Vajrasattva, which involves some visualization and things like that that are a little different than the practices we've been doing up till now. But in this practice, Tonglen, imagine that we're taking the suffering of someone. Start out with yourself, okay? And you imagine that you're taking on the suffering of yourself. Like I said, it could be sometimes really helpful to see yourself when you were a child, or when you were particularly vulnerable, something happened, or maybe it's just you now and just the collective of all the things that the suffering that you've experienced, and particularly your future suffering. Imagine that we're going to take that away as we breathe in. Imagine that suffering that you will experience in the future, you're going to breathe that in gradually into your left nostril, in the form of a black smoke. It's going to go down into your heart and destroy the selfish, self-cherishing mind, which is the, you know, the demon here. And as you, and then you kind of, your body's filled with light, this healing light of loving kindness. And as you breathe out your right nostril, you imagine that you're breathing out this, this white light that goes out to the you and wishes you happiness and the causes of happiness. You know, may you be safe, happy, healthy, live with ease. So we breathe in through the left nostril, the suffering. You know, while we're doing that, we may think, may I be free of suffering and its causes. As you breathe in that suffering in the form of black smoke, going to your heart, destroying yourself, selfish, self-cherishing mind. And then you breathe out this white light, which goes out to the you you envision in front of you, giving you happiness and its causes. So this is kind of like taking away the suffering of you is the action of compassion. And giving you loving kindness is the action of giving love. So we're practicing compassion, cultivating compassion and loving kindness. Let's just do this for a couple of minutes and then we'll do the dedication. And we're using our imagination. So when you breathe out that suffering, you imagine, you think to yourself that you really have taken away the suffering of the you that you're visualizing in front of you. And that when you give, you know, this white light of loving kindness and, loving kindness, that you're actually giving yourself love and kindness. Just use your imagination to train your mind. Okay, so that is it. Let's do the dedication prayers. Thank you for your attention. And Shantideva 246. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay. Thank you for your attention. So next week will be our last class. I haven't been very good about handing out homework. So just finish the reading. If you're committed to it, finish the reading. At least, I recommended two books, but I think this was the one that most people have access to. You're welcome to it. This one's also, these are the two books that we recommend. If you have time to read both of them, fantastic. This one's more from the Theravada, you know, mindfulness tradition, insight tradition, and this is a combination, basically. So, thank you.